We are following news out of Barcelona, Spain, where a van crashed into a crowd in the iconic Ramblas pedestrian section of the city. Government officials say at least two are dead. It's reportedly being treated as an act of terrorism. We're going to have more in a bit. Here at home, there's still reaction to a car plowing into protesters in Charlottesville and the images of Nazis marching there. Those images came to us from Vice TV. Deeper in their reporting of this past weekend, the hate groups talk about the ethnic cleansing they hope for.
We greatly outnumbered the anti-white, anti-American filth. And at some point, we will have enough power that we will clear them from the streets forever. That which is degenerate in white countries will be removed.
Robert Ray from the Daily Stormer in the Vice News documentary of last weekend's rally. We'll link you at herenow.org. Reporter Ellie Reeve embedded herself with the white supremacists. She joins us now from WVTF in Charlottesville. Ellie, you've been following these groups for a long time, and you say they have a new strategy now. What's that?
Well, they've been studying the organizing tactics of the left, and they seek to emulate that. So instead of burning crosses, they have a media strategy. They want to look like victims. They want to look like the police are shutting them down. They want to look like the city is shutting them down. That makes it seem like their ideas are so powerful and so dangerous that the establishment can't stand to have people say them publicly because others will start to follow them.
Well, we're hearing Steve Bannon, who, of course, is now the president's advisor and ran Breitbart News, which he's bragged was a platform for the alt-right. We hear him saying today to the New York Times that he is loving the fact that those on the left are pulling down statues. He said, bring it on, because it makes the left look as if it's victimizing the right. That's my interpretation of what he said. And so you are hearing this from the supremacists, but they also told you that they want to borrow from the camaraderie of the left.
That's right. They only know each other online. They only know each other through screen names. And so finally coming together and being part of a physical space really is emboldening for them. Yeah. It makes them feel good to know that there are others who are willing to show their face and say they believe in these things.
Yeah. Well, and they told you about some other things on their agenda, including moving beyond the sitting president. You spoke with Christopher Cantwell. He's one of the white supremacist leaders. Let's listen.
I'm here to spread ideas, talk, in the hopes that somebody more capable will come along and do that. Somebody like Donald Trump, who does not give his daughter to a Jew.
So Donald Trump, but like more racist.
A lot more racist than Donald Trump. I don't think that you could feel about race the way I do and watch that Kushner walk around with that beautiful girl, okay?
Of course, he's referring to Jared Kushner, who is Jewish, who married Donald Trump's daughter, who converted to Judaism. That's how he feels about it.
Yes. I think something people are reluctant to point out is how focused this movement is on sex, particularly white women. Who gets to have sex with white women? They think that the media inundates people with messages that women should sleep with minorities instead of white men, that white men are goofy or doofuses. There's a sitcom dad stereotype of the hapless white male. And so they're very focused on reproduction and creating more Aryan babies.
And so there's that. And
yeah.
You know, were you shocked at how these are things that people don't normally say for broadcast? I mean, they knew who you were. They don't normally say for broadcast that they want a president who's more racist than Donald Trump, because Donald Trump allows Jews into his family. They want to eliminate blacks, Hispanics, not just, you know, there's sort of a myth of a nationalist movement that they just want a separate country. These people you talked to didn't seem to. They want to rid the country.
Well, they think the only way to have their white nation is through violent means.
They're very clear, very clear.
These guys have been online for a long time, saying these horrible things in message boards, but it's slowly building up to being more and more public. They also have a huge network of podcasts. Some of them have 100,000 listeners a week that say very, very hateful, violent things about minorities, women, Jews. And so saying it on camera is just one more step forward.
Yeah. And by the way, I know you don't want the attention on yourself, but on the subject. But were you ever frightened at certain points? You know, you climb into a van with several of them, you know, running to another destination, and someone says, wait a second, is that media in here? They hate the media.
A term they throw around is Lügenpresse. It's a Nazi term for lying press. Yes, there were moments of tension, but I also felt like as long as they were talking about what they believed in, they wouldn't hurt us.
At the end of the weekend, Christopher Cantwell, again, one of the white supremacist leaders who, you know, seems to have a connection with you. I mean, he tells you quite a bit. You go to his hotel room. He's returning to his home in Roanoke Rapids, Virginia. He's packing up. He dumps a display of weapons, including assault rifles, pistols, a knife that he's got all over his body. He tells you that he thinks the death of Heather Heyer was justified. And then he says this.
I think that a lot more people are going to die before we're done here, frankly.
Why?
Why? Because people die every day, right? I mean,
like of a heart attack. I mean, violent death.
Well, people die violent deaths all the time, right? Like, this is part of the reason that we want an ethno-state, right? So, like, the blacks are killing each other in staggering numbers from coast to coast. We don't really want to have a part of that anymore. And so the fact that they resist us when we say, hey, we want a homeland, is not shocking to me, all right? These people want violence, and the right is just meeting market demand.
Meeting market demand. Ellie, you know the debate. There are those who say that this is still a small group of hate groups and that to respond to them only elevates them. And as you said, this is what they want. They want the images that appear to make them look like victims. What's your sense of how concerned Americans should be?
The reason I've been following this movement for a while is that they are targeting a different demographic than we usually associate with racists. They are going after the college-educated, the tech-savvy, the media-savvy. And you could see that in the march, right? I heard that from all kinds of friends. Like, they look just like a regular guy. They look like someone I know. Mm-hmm. That's an intentional strategy. They want to look like successful, good-looking, fit people. Like, they have told me that explicitly. I think it's really important to show exactly what they believe, that this is not just being anti-PC or you know, angering that the scolding liberal feminist teachers, right? Like, they believe really terrible things. And in order to fight their arguments, we have to know what they are.
That's Ellie Reeve of Vice News. We'll link you to her reports from Charlottesville at hereandnow.org. Ellie, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
This month marks the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's death, and it is a truth universally acknowledged that Jane Austen fans must be in want of a stage adaptation. See what we did there? The opening line of one of Austen's most adored works, Pride and Prejudice, the story of the five Bennet sisters and various potential grooms, including Misters Bingley and Darcy, is, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." The new stage adaptation by playwright and actor Kate Hamill, on stage at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival in Garrison, New York, is Jane Austen like you've never seen it. Some of the Bennet sisters are played by men, and then there's a disco scene where an enthusiastic Mr. Bingley coaxes a reluctant Mr. Darcy to dance in a fist-pumping group formation at the Long's Ball.
Darcy! Company.
It is loud.
Hamill stars as Elizabeth Bennet opposite her real-life boyfriend Jason O'Connell as Mr. Darcy. She joins us from the festival where the show runs through Labor Day before moving to New York in November. Kate, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, so much fun to think about this adaptation, but did you write it just so you could play Elizabeth?
Definitely not. It would be a lot of work to put in. You know, this is my second Jane Austen adaptation. Mm-hmm. The first one I wrote was Sense and Sensibility, which ran for about a year off Broadway with Bedlam. And I really wanted to do the Austens in the order that she wrote them. Pride and Prejudice was next. And it's also sort of the biggest Austen Mountain to climb because it's the most famous.
Okay, so why Jane Austen and why do this? Are you a Janeite, which of course is what the devoted fans of Jane Austen are called? There's books written, in fact, one of them was written by Claudia Johnson. It's the history of Austen cults. There are real cults. And in it, Johnson describes Jane Austen as a life that passed calmly and smoothly, resembling some translucent stream which meanders through our English meadows. Are you a Janeite?
I would have to, in fact, define myself as a Janeite. I always think that it's funny that Johnson described her in this very docile way because she was very cutting and funny and witty and incisive and sarcastic and could be quite mean if you read her letters. So I always thought it was so funny that she's thought of as this very placid person and as a very placid storyteller.
Well, I would add, you know, take that, critics who kind of eye-roll at Jane Austen and misunderstand that hers are just stories about young women desperate to get married. In the time, they had so few choices, and there was a whole societal thing going on. But as you said, in many cases, including Elizabeth's, they turned down a lot of suitors, too.
Yeah. Well, I actually think there is an element of sexism in how Jane Austen is popularly thought of, because she's sort of dismissed as someone who wrote romantic comedies. And it's true that the romance and the love in them is so beautiful, but actually the comedy and the social commentary in it is just as good as any other preeminent male writer. They're very pointed novels, and that's part of what I love so much right. about them.
Well, back to Pride and Prejudice. Elizabeth, the oldest sister, hikes through the mud to help an ill sister, travels the globe, it sometimes feels like, helping other people before realizing that she has misread Mr. Darcy. After all, he is Colin Firth. Oh, wait, that's the movie. And she decides that he's the one. But let's listen to a little of what you've done here. This is the very beginning when Elizabeth and her four sisters are being led, and in your adaptation, military style, by their mother, Mrs. Bennet, to a ball at the Bingley's house. Mr. Bingley, seen as quite a catch. Let's just listen there to this march to the ball. Quite like that. But, I mean, this is not your grandmother's Jane Austen. What else were you trying to do here?
I'm a big believer that when you're creating an adaptation or, in fact, any piece of art, that you should have a strong point of view on it. And one of the big challenges for me writing Pride and Prejudice was it's so popular and it's been done so many times that there actually are pretty good straightforward versions of it out there. I would say the BBC series is a really incredible example of that. And I love to create pieces of theater that are highly theatrical and that are surprising. What I like to do is for the audience to come in expecting something and come out being like, wow, that was completely different from what I expected. We think of it as this dated text, but the truth is all of these rules and behaviors around love, we still very much follow today. You know, there are literally books out there called The Rules and The Game. And it's particularly codified for young women, especially today. And I am a young woman who happens to be in a partnership. And I'm someone who's historically been very ambivalent about marriage.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that ambivalence and your partnership, because you are on stage with your partner. As we said, your longtime boyfriend, Jason O'Connell, plays Mr. Darcy. And here's a clip where he, Mr. Darcy, playing Mr. Darcy, visits Elizabeth, played by you, in the rectory. Now, you're pretending to be sick to avoid church services. You're kind of annoyed with him. He, Darcy, is trying to proclaim his love for you, Elizabeth. Let's listen.
Something is happening, something beyond our control, something arranged over our heads has changed. In vain, I have struggled. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you.
That's you with the hand.
Look,
what was that like? You have made clear that a part of this is about expressing your ambivalence about marriage as all your 30-something friends are getting married. And here you are in this performance with the guy who I'm assuming would like to spend some time with you. How's that going?
Well, in a way, this play for me, I'm someone who really believes that unless you put yourself into the play as the playwright, it's not going to be very good. The pages need to bleed, as someone once said. So this is really about me exploring different kinds of matches. Charlotte Lucas chooses a very rational match, someone who can set her up with a fortune, and she's sort of miserable. Lydia, the youngest Bennett sister, runs off impetuously with someone, and that makes her sort of miserable. So one of the matches I had to explore is what happens when you're someone who's been very ambivalent about marriage and you're with someone who probably you're going to marry, and what that kind of panic of love, how you fight that. So doing this with Jason is especially evocative, and it's about learning that you maybe don't know all the answers about how you thought your life in love was going to be. You know, I was looking forward to having 40 cats later in life or whatever. But instead, I fell in love with this, you know, wonderful man who, he says, a proposal I wrote every night to myself, which is super weird.
Wait, did I just hear you say, are you saying that this performance every night is kind of your proposal to him?
I guess you could say that. I think it's about exploring what it was to fall in love and reconcile with the idea of getting married when I was so opposed to it.
Well, two things, Kate Hamill. First of all, this sounds a whole lot more fun than couples therapy. And two, you are sounding so Jane Austen.
I feel a real connection to Jane Austen. I mean, part of what started me writing, I was an actor before I was a playwright, is because I was so frustrated at the dearth of female narratives in the theater. I mean, a statistic I often quote is 3/4 of all new adaptations and plays produced last year were by men. And when you add on to that that the classics are almost entirely by men, then we're talking a lot of male narratives, and there's nothing wrong with the male narrative. I love men. But, you know, that means that women so often are playing these tertiary roles. I went, I really wish there were more female classics. And so then I was like, oh, God, I'm going to have to write one, aren't I?
See, if I want to have something done, I'm going to have to do it myself. Jane Austen.
Yeah, and it was so, I know, and it's, well, the first person I thought of was Jane Austen because she was a young woman. So I felt like, okay, as a young woman, do I have some way to collaborate with Jane Austen? And that's how I got into it. And her ghost hasn't haunted me yet, so.
That's Kate Hamill, starring in her own adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, a co-production between the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival and Primary Stages. It's heading for Off-Broadway, though. So for more, go to hereandnow.org. Kate, thanks so much.
It was really fun. I really appreciate it.
And later today on All Things Considered, the efforts in California already underway to end the cash-based bail system. A recent murder in San Francisco has some questioning the risk assessment computer tool that many hope will replace cash bail.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said today that, quote, there is no winner in a trade war with the U.S. That comment comes after the White House chief strategist Steve Bannon told the American Prospect magazine that we're at economic war with China. Bannon also said the U.S. is losing that war. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider, and she joins us now from New York. Hi there, Lynette.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, it's going all right. So let's talk a little bit more about what Steve Bannon said about China. First, sort of give us the Bannon worldview about why he thinks the U.S. is at economic war with China.
Bannon is a very aggressive individual, clearly. He believes that China has abused its membership in the WTO since it entered in 2001 and basically, you know, taken advantage of the rules of the system to push goods into the United States and destroy the U.S. manufacturing sector. It's kind of it's a bit far-fetched considering the fact that U.S. manufacturing decline has been going on since the 1980s, late 1970s. But he puts a lot of emphasis on China's role and believes that there is basically an irrepressible conflict coming between the United States and China in terms of for the role of global hegemon.
Right. I mean, the president has often talked about steel dumping from China. And,
sure.
And Bannon does talk about it in terms of sort of existential ways, right?
Right. I mean, to him, he's as zealous about this as he is about his belief in a war against Islamic terrorism or whatever he would prefer to call it. Throughout this interview, he kind of is very candid about how this is his first priority and the Trump administration was never really going to strike North Korea. But the problem is that an economic war with China would be just as damaging to the United States as it would be to China. You know, China is the number one buyer of our soybeans. It buys 62% of those. It is the number one buyer of U.S. planes. And these are a lot of things that would actually hurt Trump's base, because you also have to think that the cost of goods that we buy from China would go up. Retailers like Walmart would immediately start complaining if he really started to wage war. That said, on Monday, the president signed a measure that's supposed to look into whether or not we should have an investigation into Chinese intellectual property violations. Mm-hmm. That has been an issue around the world, but the way that they plan on tackling it is outside of the World Trade Organization, which China has said is a big no-no. And in fact, the U.S. would have said was a big no-no, you know, 9 months ago.
Right. So, but you know, on the other hand, China's strength as an economic powerhouse, a global economic powerhouse, is, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who share that opinion and are kind of distrustful of China's intentions vis-a-vis trade with the U.S. But within the Trump administration, I mean, how prevailing is the Bannon view on going to economic war with China? Do other members of the administration, aside from the president, share that view?
There's the president's trade advisor, head of his National Trade Council. His name is Peter Navarro. But when you look at guys like Gary Cohn and, Steve Mnuchin, they tend to be a little bit more level-headed because they're bankers. They understand the global economy and they understand that if you bother one thing in the economy, it has ripples, it has effects all over the world. And that's how we've structured it.
Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent with Business Insider. Thank you so much, Lynette.
Have a good one.
White House chief strategist Steve Bannon says there's no military solution to North Korea's growing nuclear weapons program. That was from an interview published yesterday by the American Prospect. Going against President Trump's threat of fire and fury, Bannon also suggested that Trump should accept the reality of a nuclear-armed North Korea. So we're going to take a step back now and ask, just how did we get here? Specifically, how did North Korea's nuclear program come to be? Well, James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. James, welcome to the show. And first of all, just sort of set the table here for us. Why did North Korea begin its nuclear weapons program in earnest in the 1990s?
Well, actually, North Korea's nuclear weapons program dates back probably to the 1950s or the 1960s. Mm. It accelerated in the 1990s. I actually think there may be an argument that North Korea's motivations for wanting nuclear weapons has changed over time. North Korea sees existential threats coming from outside, from the United States, rightly or wrongly. And I think the North Korean regime believes that nuclear weapons are necessary for the long-term survival of that regime.
Hmm. So, of course, nuclear power and nuclear weaponry, much overlap there, but also slightly different. I mean, where did the country get the expertise to develop viable nuclear weapons?
Well, a lot of North Korean scientists originally were trained in the Soviet Union. But I think there's been too much emphasis recently on assuming that the North Koreans now can't do it themselves. Mm. I think North Korea has reached a pretty high degree of indigenous capability, particularly in terms of things like manufacturing rocket engines, in terms of their expertise to develop warheads. But I think the extent to which they're reliant on foreign expertise and technology has decreased markedly over time.
Okay, interesting. So, as you said, originally they relied on other countries for physical materials, equipment, etc., but they can do that in North Korea now, including the fissile material for a nuclear warhead or even a nuclear reactor.
Yeah, they're producing that themselves. I mean, they've long had a plutonium production reactor, and they have the capability, the reprocessing technology to extract plutonium from that reactor. They've shown off a very, very advanced centrifuge plant to a group of visiting Americans. That was about 6 or 7 years ago now. We don't know exactly how many of these centrifuge plants they have, but they have the ability to enrich uranium.
Well, there's actually a point of clarification I should have asked a little earlier. So when you say that the North Korean nuclear program began in the 1950s, was that for power or original, or was the concept of building a nuclear weapon there from the beginning?
It was a dual-use program. A number of technologies, as you've already pointed out, are used for both nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And all of the technology that the North Koreans were starting to get interested in the 1950s, and the program moved very, very slowly back then, was dual-use technology that was entirely applicable towards both ends.
You know, so we can talk about in a minute about what options are for the international community, given all you've just said. But it makes me wonder, okay, so here we have a situation in which, you know, a nation that was largely thought to be challenged because of its regime and its economy in terms of developing nuclear weapons. It's done it successfully, initially with the help of outside countries, but now on its own. What lessons can the international community draw from that regarding perhaps other nations that may want to start a nuclear program?
What I would say is this. Nuclear weapons technology is 1940s technology. It's going to become increasingly accessible to an ever larger group of states. And what that tells me is that the technological solutions to nonproliferation are going to become increasingly effective, and that political solutions, I think, are going to be our key barriers to nonproliferation in the future. There's lots of lessons there with North Korea. I think the international community was very, very slow and lacked seriousness in trying to enforce nonproliferation rules. I think we need to get a lot better at that in the future.
So an exceedingly important point then. So how the international community and North Korea then proceed from this point on is also demonstrative for what you just said. If we can achieve political solutions to contain the further development or spread proliferation of nuclear weapons. So, I mean, obviously tensions between the United States and North Korea are terrible right now. So, I mean, what do you see as possible next steps?
Well, I'm kind of a pessimist when it comes to North Korea. I think denuclearization, as desirable as that would be, is now out the window. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, last night, I think, in Seoul, described a North Korea with nuclear weapons capable of reaching the United States as unimaginable. I find it hard to describe something that's already happened as being unimaginable. Unfortunately, it's all too imaginable. And as I say, I think denuclearization is off the table. I think what we have to do right now is pursue a risk reduction agenda with North Korea. I believe that we should try to offer a deal to the North Koreans. They're not allowed to conduct missile tests that overfly Japan or South Korea, which would preclude them flying a missile anywhere near Guam. In return, we should be prepared to say no training flights of strategic bombers within a certain agreed distance of North Korea. I think that would help to de-escalate the current crisis, which is still very much alive, by the way. And I think that would help prevent the occurrence of future crises. It's these and similar kind of risk reduction measures that I think are our least bad option now with North Korea.
James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Police in Spain are responding to what they're calling a terrorist attack today in Barcelona. A van plowing into a crowd in the popular tourist area known as Las Ramblas. There are fatalities. At least 32 are injured, 10 seriously. The BBC's Rich Preston joins us from London. Rich, what do we know?
Well, Robin, this happened at about 5 p.m. Barcelona time, which is 11 a.m. Eastern. Now, Las Ramblas is a busy tourist area in the heart of Barcelona, a big wide boulevard leading down to the waterfront, full of cafes, restaurants, bars. Now, at that time, it will have been filled with people, tourists and locals alike. One eyewitness who spoke to the BBC described it as jam-packed. Yeah. Now, as usual with these sorts of things, the first reports came through on social media, reports of a white van plowing into pedestrians, and this happened in a pedestrianised area. Authorities have since described it as a massive crash, and they are calling it a terrorist attack.
Yeah, and if you've been there and know this beautiful area, it's a huge pedestrian path down the middle. The cars are on either side, so one can just envision how many people might have been on that path in the middle. And there are now reports of, you know, armed perpetrators barricaded in a restaurant. What more do we know there?
Yes, now local media are reporting that the driver fled on foot. Police have ordered the closure of metro and railway stations, presumably to try and prevent anyone fleeing the scene. And local media are saying that two armed men entered a restaurant. So we're following developments on that.
Do we know if there are hostages there?
No, we don't know that at the moment, Robin.
All right. Spanish police are urging people not to circulate images of the injured. We are seeing, though, terrible pictures on cell phones start to come out. Pretty horrendous scene.
Yes. Now, unfortunately, this is something that is becoming more common here. Now, one witness told the BBC he saw the van going, quote, full pelt down the middle of the street and that it wasn't slowing down at all. And he said he knew immediately that this was a terrorist attack. And why? Because that's what we've seen recently here in Europe. The truck attack in Nice in summer 2016, the Berlin Christmas market attack in Germany, and more recently, where I am in London, the attacks on Westminster Bridge and Borough Market. So I can only imagine the sense of panic that filled the crowd.
Well,
of
course, we have the images here in the US from this past weekend of a car plowing into people in Charlottesville, Virginia. Look, give us some context in the minute we have. How much tension is there in Spain over what, immigration or terrorism? What might be behind this?
Well, immigration is a contentious topic across Western Europe at the moment, and we've seen that play out in the media. Now, I can't say too much about Spain and how it's affected politics there, but the topic of immigration is certainly something that politicians and people following politics will talk about regularly.
Yeah. The BBC's Rich Preston speaking to us there from London about today's apparent terrorist attack in Barcelona, a van plowing into pedestrians on the iconic Las Ramblas Boulevard, one of the most beautiful in Europe, plowing into tourists and residents there. We'll follow the story all day on NPR. Rich, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
And by the way, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says the consulate in Spain is helping Americans there. You might contact them if you have loved ones abroad. We are setting aside the headlines for now because it is August, and that means corn on the cob, of course, which I eat like a horse over a feed bag. But here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has more ideas. Kathy, this is such a great time
of
year.
Okay, I can't get that image out of my
head.
She's
far more elegant than any horse.
Can you
all
neigh?
The horses are beautiful.
Can you neigh for us?
Well, I mean, that's what you do. You just lean over just like...
I can't get enough
like
corn
a typewriter.
Either.
I need more metaphors here.
You
just
go
across the corn. But
all right, let's get to it.
Yeah, okay. What can we learn?
Enough of you being a horse, right?
what can we learn?
Well, of course, it is corn season. It is August. Corn is in season and available everywhere. Anyone that buys corn from a supermarket, I can't.
No?
I mean, unless you trust your supermarket and you know that it comes in fresh every morning.
Because what happens?
Here's what happens. Okay, yeah. I brought an ear of corn in.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I want you to see. I know that listeners can't hear it, but the tassels are dark brown, black. They're fresh. There's a smell to this corn. And listen to the sound, okay? I'm shucking it. Oh, my God. I'm getting squirted with corn milk.
Yep.
It's juicy. Now, when you go shopping, you want to do that, right?
You have to see.
Yeah. Everybody, yeah. But no, you don't have to see. You actually can push on the ear of corn. And if it's firm and it feels heavy, that means it's fresh. Oh. Ideally, yeah, you want to stick your fingernail into the cob and have it squirt corn
And you do
juice.
Want to take one shuck. I mean, just
but
see
that. A lot of stores really, and particularly in farmers market, because every time I pull one of these back, okay, I'm going to do it again. Shuck it. You are drying the ear of corn out. It's being exposed to the air. Here's the other really important thing. This corn was picked this morning. So everything that you're eating in a minute is corn that was just picked this morning. It is sweet and juicy.
So make sure it's fresh.
Very fresh, because what happens to corn is as soon as it sits, the sugars convert to starch. So if you taste corn tonight that you picked this morning, it's a bit starchier. If you forget to cook it tonight and you eat it tomorrow, it's going to be super starchy.
I was just at a farm stand, and there was a guy really irritated there because I guess somebody had come in and, you know, done one shuck on 10 pieces and left
And it
them.
Ruins it. Yeah, and they can't. Yeah. You don't want to buy a pre-shucked piece of corn. You should not want to.
Exactly.
So we could eat in a minute. Can I eat
okay,
now?
Okay, go. You go.
Okay, what do we got here?
Now you got to learn. You don't wait around
don't
here.
And by the way, I'm eyeing your plate too. So we've got cornbread here, but it doesn't look bright yellow like traditional cornbread.
No, so this is a fabulous buttermilk cornbread. It's made with cornmeal, but I also add a lot of that fresh corn. So I shucked the corn from this morning and I put it in a tall bowl and I use my big knife and I cut right down the cob and I get the kernels. And then I take the blunt side of the knife and scrape down and I get what's called the corn milk. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of flavor still besides the kernels. So it's buttermilk, cornbread with fresh corn, a lot of fresh herbs. And I also added some goat cheese.
I love it.
There's like a layer of custard on top. You make it in a cast iron or a heavy skillet. It's a one dish thing. It's almost a meal, right?
Mm-hmm. And how'd you get the top?
So what you do is you add buttermilk and you add 1 cup of milk, bake it for 15 minutes. Then you add the 2nd cup of milk and continue baking, and it creates a custard layer
on
top.
You pour it over the top.
Yes. It's
wonderful.
Kind of brilliant, if she does say so herself. All right. Moving along.
We'll attest to that.
Scallops.
Okay. Scallops and corn. They're both sweet. They're both meaty. So I thought, what about sautéing some corn off the cob with fresh basil, and those tomatoes are from my garden. And then I sautéed scallops. I dredged them in flour with salt and pepper in a very hot skillet with some olive oil.
Dredge them, just knock them around in there in flour?
Yeah. Knock them around.
Yeah.
This is the horse talking again. Yeah, you just lightly flour them. It's a delicate process. And then a hot skillet, about 2 or 3 minutes on each side. And scallops are very sweet. I adore them. You could do this with shrimp. You could do this with a lot of fish. Because seafood and corn go really, really well.
Yeah.
So you have that sweet bed underneath it and that meaty scallop. And then the third thing you're going to eat is a salad. And it is sautéed corn with a little bit of garlic and olive oil with fresh chopped cucumbers, tomatoes, and a very creamy feta cheese.
I picked
wonderful.
The right day to be here.
You did.
You did, right? Except for the news.
Yeah. How do you store corn if you're not going to use it immediately?
Well, you shouldn't.
You should
honestly,
use it immediately.
I mean, it can be frozen. You can make relish. You can do all kinds of things with it. But buy it in the morning. Eat it that day. I can't stress it enough.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're eating starch.
I've got more questions.
Okay,
grilling.
Good.
Grill or boil? And when you grill, do you keep it chucked? How do you do that?
You can do it either or. Grilling is a terrific way to do it. If you're going to keep the husk on, you want to soak it in cold water for at least 15 or 20 minutes so that when it hits the heat of the grill, it kind of steams inside the husk and cooks beautifully. Or you can pull the husk off and grill it, and then you can coat it in, you know, Mexican street style with crumbled cheese, herbs, butter, etc. And steaming, of course, the classic pot of boiling water. Throw in the corn. Some people say 4 minutes. Some people say 1 minute. I like to boil it, throw it in, turn it off, cover it, scream, dinner.
Okay.
And then we eat.
And you are so lucky if she's yelling dinner at you. Here Now resident chef Kathy Guntz will have all her recipes at herenow.org. Kathy, thanks.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.